Agreed. Jason, if you'd let us know what we're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 402 eliminates the sunset date for the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Program, allows the Economic Development Department to transfer an increased amount of money to loss reserve accounts of financial institutions under the Capital Access Program for loans made to businesses in distressed areas after June 30th, 1999. It allows the Economic Development Commission to establish the Oregon Targeted Development Account within the Oregon Business Development Fund to encourage investment in distressed areas of the state. It allows the EDD to provide loans at lower rates of interest to businesses in distressed areas under the Business Development Loan Program. Removes the requirement in distressed areas to state that a business must sell goods and services in markets for which national and international competition exists in order to receive a loan from the Credit Enhancement Fund, and declares an emergency effective June 30th, 1999.
Fort Houston. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, member of the committee. My name is Mark Houston, and I manage business finance for the Oregon Economic Development Department, and I'm here to testify in favor of Senate Bill 402. This bill was pre-session filed by the department for consideration by this legislature. Most of this bill addresses the policy of increasing our efforts to invest in distressed areas of the state. This policy was promoted in the last legislative session with the appointment of the Interim Work Group on Economic and Community Development and the Oregon Economic Development Commission's new direction. Through statute and administrative rule, the department has defined distressed areas throughout the state. A list of those distressed areas as currently defined is included in your packet. So I think that they're just following my testimony is the list of those distressed areas. Senate Bill 402 addresses four of the business finance programs administered by the department, specifically the Oregon Business Development Fund, Sections 1, 2, and 3 of the bill, the Oregon Credit Enhancement Fund, Section 4, the Oregon Capital Access Program, Section 5, and the Oregon Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund, Sections 6, 7, and 8. In order to give you a perspective on the legislation, I'll give a quick summary of each one of the programs and then a synopsis on the new legislation. The committee may want to stop after each one of the programs and discuss any policy issues that come up. The first program is the Oregon Business Development Fund. It's a statewide revolving loan fund initiated in 1983 and is targeted at manufacturing, processing, and regionally significant tourism projects. The Oregon Business Development Fund is designed to fill a gap in a financing package, often providing subordinated higher-risk financing. The interest rate is set at one percentage point higher than a comparable term treasury bond. The fund has partnered with scores of banks, local development groups, and others to leverage private financing, and has helped companies create jobs throughout Oregon. Below are some highlights. The fund was capitalized with $11.4 million of federal, state, and lottery funds. These funds have now revolved three times. Over 250 loans have been made to businesses throughout the state. Total net earnings have grown to $5.1 million since the program's inception. The fund has an annual return on investment in 1998 at 5.1%. All staffing and loan losses are paid for by income from the fund. Since inception, the fund has leveraged over $100 million in bank and private investment in Oregon. Over 60% of the loans are made in rural areas of the state. Nearly half are for $50,000 or less. Over 4,000 jobs have been created or saved by companies financed by the Oregon Business Development Fund. And the department estimates that Oregon income tax paid by jobs created or saved is over $3 million annually. Senate Bill 402 allows the Oregon Economic Development Commission to establish a targeted development account within the Oregon Business Development Fund and transfer funds from the regular Oregon Business Development Fund to it. Monies in the targeted development account may be loaned to businesses in distressed areas of the state at a lower rate than the regular Oregon Business Development Fund rate of 1 percentage point over Treasury. This rate would be set by the Oregon Economic Development Commission. Conceptually, the economic development strategy would be fundamentally different in the targeted development account than within the regular Oregon Business Development Fund. As mentioned earlier, the regular Oregon Business Development Fund fills a gap in a funding package. The department envisions a targeted development account to be an incentive for companies to locate or invest in distressed areas of the state. The structure of the loan will be to co-invest with private lenders, with the department sharing in the senior collateral position with the bank. By partnering with the bank, the department can reduce paperwork and improve delivery mechanisms.
402.
This targeted program is based on a successful model operating in South Dakota. Funding would be provided through existing resources in the fund. So that is the changes made to the Oregon Business Development Fund. I could stop there if the committee has any questions on that, or continue at the chair's pleasure.
Please continue.
Okay. Section 2 of the bill codifies the capability of the department to waive collateral requirements in distressed areas of the state under the Oregon Business Development Fund, and codifies the Oregon Targeted Development Account. Section 3 of the bill allows the department to use the Oregon Business Development Fund monies to market public business finance programs. As part of the charge of the Interim Work Group on Economic and Community Development, the department completed a study on how various public lenders can increase cooperation and collaboration. The survey done as part of the study indicated that businesses needed more good financial advice on loan and equity funding options, and public business finance programs were confusing or uncoordinated, and that information was difficult to obtain. This statutory change would allow the department to expend funds to implement more easily some of the recommendations of the study.
Mark?
Yes.
When the change marketing public business finance, is this the department helping private sector find financing options, or is this restricted to municipals, counties, cities, special districts, in finding alternatives, better ways, cheaper money to borrow?
Mr. Chairman, this would be mostly exclusively targeted at private businesses, assisting private businesses the various funding programs operated through the state, federal, and local and regional organizations. So it would help provide that information out to businesses.
Do you have an example of an Eastern Oregon company, hopefully located in Hood River County, that has benefited from this?
I'm sorry, Mr. Chairman. Can you give me a question one more time?
I was curious in terms of if there was an Eastern Oregon company, preferably from Hood River County, as an example in terms of how it's benefited someone in distressed or rural area. And distressed, again, is defined as economic unemployment factors. And
Mr. Chairman, I'd be happy to get a full list of all of the businesses we've assisted in Hood River County, but I can think of a couple off the top that there was a company, for example, that was a manufacturer of Mexican products that was expanding in Hood River, and we participated with a bank. We provided subordinated financing. They expanded their operations, and there are a number of others and a lot of these are a lot of these programs are focused on existing businesses in the state, existing small businesses in the state that are expanding.
Mr. Chairman, Representative for the advertisement. Since he brought up the company, you might also indicate that they paid the loan back early, too, didn't they?
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, Representative Montgomery, they did. Would you like me to continue?
Yes, please.
Section 4 of the bill amends the Oregon Credit Enhancement Program. The Oregon Credit Enhancement Program was initiated by the 1993 legislature. The Credit Enhancement Fund provides guarantees of bank-originated loans. The program is targeted to companies that trade in national or international markets. These would be manufacturers, processors, high-technology companies, et cetera. To date, we've guaranteed 116 loans from 23 different banks around the state. Highlights, again, of that fund, it's been capitalized with $7.6 million of lottery funds. Total net earnings have grown to over $900,000 since program inception. We're also getting a positive return on investment of 3.6% annually in 1997. All staffing and loan losses are paid for by income from the fund. We've leveraged over $26 million in small business funding from banks in Oregon. 51% of the loans have been made in rural areas of the state. 23% of the loans have been made to emerging small businesses in the state. The major objective of this fund was to increase working capital availability for small businesses. Over 75% of the guaranteed funds were used for working capital. and over 600 jobs have been created or saved by companies financed with the Oregon Credit Enhancement Fund. The proposed legislation would expand the eligible applicants to the Oregon Credit Enhancement Fund to include any type of business if it is located in a distressed area of the state.
Does that dilute the availability of those funds in terms of where are we at today in terms of have people been denied because there's not adequate funds, or is this opening up additional opportunities?
Mr. Chairman, and these are ballpark numbers, but we have about $12 million in exposure currently. We have about $9 million in reserve funds actually in the state. Our staff and our committee feels that a 4-to-1 leverage is very conservative, so we have plenty of room at this point to continue through this next biennium. This will increase activity, though, in the fund. There are substantially more retail and service type businesses than there are manufacturing type businesses in the state. So this is we would anticipate an increase in activity. And Section 5 of the bill is related to the Oregon Capital Access Program. Began in 1990, the Capital Access Program is a unique partnership with the Oregon banking community to encourage investment in small businesses throughout the state. The department provides a matching contribution to a loan loss reserve account established in each participating bank. To date, the department has rolled 29 banks, 19 are active. The program is designed to be flexible and non-bureaucratic. And again, highlights the fund was capitalized with $2.3 million, and continued funding is provided through transfers from the Oregon Business Development Fund. The fund has leveraged over $52 million in small business funding from banks in Oregon, over 1,400 small businesses. The leverage ratio of private funds to public funds is 23-to-1, meaning $23 of private bank funds are invested for every lottery dollar contributed to the loan loss reserve account. The average capital access fund loan is $37,000, so this is a program that's really targeted towards small businesses. Over 30% of the loans have been made to startup businesses in the state, and over 2,000 direct jobs have been created or saved by companies financed with the Oregon Capital Access Program. The department currently provides a 2-to-1 match for loan loss reserve accounts for loans made in distressed areas of the state. To date, the department has guaranteed 418 loans, or 28% of the loans in the Capital Access Program in distressed areas of the state, totaling $15 million in small business investments. The proposed statutory change would eliminate the sunset date, currently slated for June 30, 1999, for the increased match feature of the Oregon Capital Access Program. So this would continue this incentive in the distressed areas into the future. Okay. Sections 6 through 8 of the bill are related to the Oregon Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. This program was established by the 1991 legislature. Initially, the program was targeted to timber-dependent communities, but the 1993 legislature extended the program statewide. Under the program, the department may make loans to startup businesses that have completed a business plan and is receiving business counseling from a small business development center or other certified entity. The maximum initial loan is $25,000. The follow-on loan can be made but the two total loans cannot exceed $40,000. The fund has been capitalized with $1.6 million of lottery funds, and continued resources are provided through revolving amounts in the fund, which should last through the next biennium. Through June 30, 1998, 128 entrepreneurial development loan funds were made, totaling $1.6 million. All of the loans have been made for $25,000 or less. The average loan is $12,500. The fund has leveraged over $400,000 in private investment. Nearly 60% of the loans have been made in rural areas of the state. 35% have been made in distressed areas of the state. Over 40% of the funds have been funded working capital, a major financing need for small startup companies. The proposed legislation would eliminate the sunset date on the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund and establish the program in statute. As part of your package, I also included a letter that on the Senate side. There were several questions that committee asked regarding loans to women and minority businesses and default rates related to each one of these programs, and that information is included in your packet, along with the statutory language related to the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund.
Any questions for Mark? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Could you tell us what percentage of the firms who have received loans under this program have failed to comply with the terms of their loan?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, actually, the letter that was to Senator Lim is that's in your packet, I think, is probably would give you the best overview of that. Each program is a little different. If I could go quickly through that.
Yes.
The Capital Access Program lost claims to date at 4.7% of the total. So 4.7% or approximately 5% of the companies have failed, and the banks are making a claim against the loss reserve account in the Capital Access Program.
If I may, just follow just real quick. Who do they make the claim to?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Crummell, under this program, a loan loss reserve account is set up in each participating bank. When a loan defaults, the bank sends us a note or a letter indicating that it has defaulted and the amount of the claim. Then we approve the bank removing money from the loan loss reserve account. That account is set up in the state's name until there is a claim made against that reserve account, and then we approve that that release.
Thank you. Mark, just before I go back to Representative Witt, in terms of this is talking about number of loans, what is it in terms of the total funds? So we 4% were a bunch of small loans, and or do we have one really big loan and it's, you know, 95% of the fund was defaulted? And
Mr. Chairman, I believe, and I'll go back and check this. These numbers are by total. I'm confident these are by total loan amounts. It's not by number of, but it's approximately the same for each one of them. But I'll go back and get those specific numbers for you in the committee.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Now, there's in this letter you talk about four different funds,
right.
I believe, right?
Correct.
One being the Entrepreneurial Development Loan Fund. That shows 11.4%.
Correct.
Loan losses. Why is that one that much higher than the others? And if you netted this all out, how would these losses compare with, let's say, typical commercial lending in terms of loan loss?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, to address your first question related to the Entrepreneurial Loan Fund, and I was here when the program was established, and I think that the legislature recognized that this would be a high-risk program. All of these loans are made to startup businesses. The company cannot qualify unless it's a startup business. So the universe of companies we're working with is by definition a higher risk. And it is a high. These numbers, I think, are comparable to what we see in other microloan programs, startup microloan programs across the country for this type of lending. And it is high. I think we see approximately 25% of the companies struggle or fail. That's the negative. On the positive side, we see 75% succeed. And this is definitely, I think, a policy issue for the legislature. These are what I would classify more as mom and pop kind of companies that would receive a loan from the lottery, and again, higher risk types of activities.
Mark, would it not be true to say that these people would not otherwise get loans if it were not for this program?
Mr. Chairman, that's for the Entrepreneurial Loan Fund, I think we can say that unequivocally. These are if they had another option to get funding, they would get that funding. I think that is true generally across the board for all of these programs. There's built-in features to that were filling a gap, that were leveraging resources, that were.
Yeah, to follow up on the chair's question there, isn't it true, though, that the interest rate charged on these loans is significantly below what a market rate would be if these same businesses were going out to their local bank to get a loan or some other institution to get a loan? So to say that the fact that they have a loan here through through this program would indicate that they couldn't have gotten a commercial loan doesn't seem necessarily logical to me.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, let me address that two ways. First, on the two guarantee programs, the state charges a fee in addition to the regular commercial rate that a bank would charge. So there's a fee on top of the regular commercial rate. So in those cases, there's not a below market rate feature in any of those programs, in any of the guarantee programs. The Oregon Business Development Fund does have a below market rate feature, and it is our amount is limited to 40% of the total loan made. So generally, a bank or another private lender is going to make at least 50% of the loan in each one of these cases. As a additional safeguard, if you will, and the concept of the Oregon Business Development Fund is to fill a gap in a financing package. So we're providing subordinated, definitely higher risk financing. Each one of these loans is reviewed by our finance committee, except for loans under $50,000. And the finance committee is made up of three bankers and two business people from the private sector. That's a part of their charge, is to review this to see whether or not, you know, this is these companies are strong enough to be able to go to the private market to be able to get the financing. And we've done a number of follow-up research and studies discussions with the companies, and I think we're fairly confident that these loans are loans that a bank would not make, and especially in a subordinated position where we're at.
Representative Deckert and Representative King, you guys go together?
No, just one at a time. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark, I was wondering, in the 23% of loans made to emerging small business, what's the brief definition of emerging small business?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Deckard, and if I'm wrong, I'll get back to you, but I believe it's under $300,000 in sales for the last average for the last 2 years for non-construction firms, and $1 million in sales for construction firms.
Representative King?
To get to the loan availability aspect, I think without the assistance of the loss reserves or the collateralization to the open market, the rate would be substantially higher. And since a lot of times these are going to be distressed businesses, that it would be true that at that higher rate, that it's not just a rate issue, that if you're at a higher interest rate and you're already pledged financially elsewhere, that higher interest rate would very possibly consume the business, and therefore they wouldn't be able to, you know, to do an open rate market. And these people probably have also already tapped out their home mortgage, you know, their families, et cetera. So this is, you know, very likely, I would think, in this category, you know, last chance, last stop. Is that true?
Mr. Chairman, Representative King, I think your portrayal of that is accurate. We have had businesses that have come, that have participated in programs previously and come to legislative committees and talk about this issue, and I think they're in a position where they, if they had to, they would pay a higher rate, but previous legislative committees have compromised, if you will, and said that this is part of our economic development incentive and assistance to businesses that are growing in the state, creating jobs, making an investment in the state for economic development.
Thank you. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just had a question about the language of the bill. It seems a little bit unclear to me from your testimony. In Section 4, and this is the Credit Enhancement Program, I think the intention of this language is to broaden the definition of a qualified business to include any business in the distressed area. But if you read the way this has been drafted, qualified business means any existing or proposed business entity with an average annual employment not exceeding 200 employees, that, except when located in a distressed area, could be read as saying that if you're located within a distressed area, you don't fall into the definition of a qualified business. And maybe legislative council knows better, but just reading that with a plain meaning, it seems very plain.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosenbaum, it is definitely the intent that, and hopefully this this will also set the record, if there's any question related to the record, that that a qualified business, that the exception is related to selling goods and or services in markets for which national or international competition exists. So it would be the clause that follows that exception.
Yeah.
I'm not a lawyer. I can't specifically say that that's correct.
Well, maybe our staff could just double check with legislative council and make sure that that does do what it is trying to do there. It does seem like it could be read in another way as to just wipe those guys out altogether.
Representative
Mr. Chairman, just to Representative Rosenbaum's point, I think the word that then shifts it to the succeeding clause. And I think it's clear that the except when located within a distressed area, relates to selling goods or services in markets for which national or international competition exists. Not the number of employees.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 402? Hearing and seeing none, let's close public hearing on Senate Bill 402. Open up discussion on Senate Bill 402. Representative Montgomery?
Mr. Chairman, I move Senate Bill 402 to the floor to do pass recommendation.
Representative Montgomery moves Senate Bill 402 to the floor for the due pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll.
Aye.
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 Excuse?
No.
Aye. Senate Bill 402 moves to the floor to pass recommendation. Open a public hearing on Senate Bill 403. Jason, you want to explain what we're looking at?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate Bill 403A establishes a safe drinking water revolving loan fund administered by the Oregon Economic Development Department in accordance with an agreement between the Economic Development Department and the Health Division.
Mr. Chair, is there a committee summary on this and on just
to be
missed by it? I'm sure Representative Witt is here to check.
Is there a question?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Doris Penwell from Economic Development Department. Senate Bill 403, proposed by the department, is a very simple bill compared to a lot of things that we have brought before you. The bill is to separate the Safe Drinking Water Act monies that come to the department, either from lottery-backed bonding or federal funds, into a separate account from the water wastewater fund that we already are operating. And I've given you testimony that explains in some detail how it works, but essentially we have operated the program for one biennium, and we have found that we have some difficulties using both of the programs out of one fund because there are some differences in several areas. Eligible recipients in the state-operated program of the Water Fund are only public entities. But federal requirements make us provide these loan funds from the Safe Drinking Water Act to both private and public purveyors of water systems. In addition to that, there are a lot of other federal regulations that are narrower than those that we have chosen to use for the state funds that have been provided by lottery funds. And in terms of the state funds, we have a lot more flexibility. We can make either grants or loans or package through the Oregon Bond Bank loans to communities, public entities, and so we have a lot more flexibility with the use of those funds. And when we tried to operate the program, both programs under the one fund, we were having to separate out everything anyway, and we finally decided that for purposes of efficiency and effectiveness, we'd better just propose this bill to separate the funding.
Very good question.
That's it, and I can answer any questions you have.
No questions. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 403? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on Senate Bill 403. Open a work session on Senate Bill 403. Representative Montgomery?
Chairman, I move Senate Bill 403A to the floor as a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Montgomery moves Senate Bill 403 and Gross to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Please call the roll. Yes. Aye.
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 Aye. Excuse me.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 403 moves to the floor of the do-pass recommendation. It's open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1083. Jason, you want to explain this, what we're looking at?
Mr. Chair, Senate Bill 1083 allows for expansion of certain energy facilities through amendment of a site certificate rather than a new site certificate from the Energy Facility Siting Council. It allows the Office of Energy to approve expansion and specifies that an amended site certificate has the same legal status as an original energy facility site certificate.
Mike Greeny and Dave Fist. Welcome.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm Mike Greeny, Assistant Director of the Office of Energy, and with me is David Stewart Smith, who's the Administrator of the Office's Energy Resources Division and provides technical staffing to our Energy Facility Siting Council. That council is a set of in-person citizen council that makes decisions on siting and regulation of large energy facilities. And what this bill does is clarifies a couple of things. First, it clarifies that an amendment to a site certificate issued by the Siting Council has the same force of law that the original site certificate does. Attorney General's office told us the law wasn't entirely clear on that, even though that was the intent, and we think that's important to for the siting process. And most of the bill, most of the different sections of the bill actually just make that change. They say site certificate or amended site certificate throughout the various parts of our siting process. Secondly, and particularly relevant to amendments of site certificates, the bill makes some clarifications regarding the siting of underground storage facilities for natural gas. And unlike most energy facilities that the design and the all the specifics are known in advance before the Siting Council makes decisions, such as for transmission lines and for electric generating stations, the underground storage facility in large part is unknown until further exploration is done. The applicant receives approval from the Siting Council to develop the storage facility subject to certain conditions in the site certificate. As that development occurs, expansion may be needed, and the company comes back to the Siting Council for either amended site certificate or for the staff to review and implement conditions. This clarifies that process and clarifies that the Office of Energy can do the administrative and some of the detailed work on behalf of the Siting Council that's within the parameters of that overall site certificate. Mr. Chairman, that's basically all the bill does. I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Any questions?
Thank you, Mr.
Tom Berry, Margaret Kirkpatrick. Welcome.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Tom Berry, representing Northwest Natural Gas, and with me is Margaret Kirkpatrick, an attorney with Stowe Reeves, who does our work with the Energy Facility Siting Council. To save your time, we don't have any written testimony. It would be redundant because what we're asking is we work with this, and we would support and ask your support for the bill. So we'll just leave it short.
Do we have any?
Do you have any questions? Margaret is their technical person.
Thank you. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on Senate Bill 1083? Hearing and seeing none, we'll close the public hearing on 1083 and open a work session on Senate Bill 1083. Representative Montgomery.
Okay, well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I move Senate Bill 1083 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Representative Montgomery moves Senate Bill 1083 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Discussion? Hearing and seeing none, will you do the floor roll, please?
President Decker?
Yes.
King?
Yes.
Aye.
Montgomery?
Aye.
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 Excuse.
Aye.
Aye. Senate Bill 1083 moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
Can I carry this?
Yes, you may. Senator Patrick Simmons volunteered, so you get to carry the bill. I appreciate I'm going to be mean and nasty here in this last couple of days. We have a deadline that we have to meet to get Senate bills out. We have big issues before us. This is going to have to happen, so I appreciate if people have issues with bills and stuff, make sure you read your bill folders beforehand and come prepared, because we will press ahead. And we've also been requested that we need to recess at 4 o'clock to go down for the purposes of helping them make a quorum on the floor, and then we'll come back up and continue. And with that,
there you go, Jerry.
Thank you, Representative Hill. No, sorry, I went to the chair. Public hearing on Senate Bill 142, and we have a list that we were working on last time, but I know that we have a... We have a group from, okay. Well, what I'd like to do is ask, is it Tom Cook and Kathy Britton and Sherman Radke to go ahead and come up if you would, please.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, Representative McGinn.
Just a procedural question. I wonder how you're going to proceed. We have a bill before us now, and then we've heard a multitude of people come forward suggesting to us some amendments to these various bills. Will there be ample time for the public to testify then when the amendments come forward, or are we going to close into work session and review the amendments as a committee and no public testimony?
My intention has been as long as the amendments are available, I'd like to have them available so that we can have an opportunity for public input on those. I'm not sure that we would go through the entire list again if we can, but I would certainly entertain people being able to comment on the amendments. Welcome, and go ahead and whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Chairman Cromwell and members of the committee. You get to see my face twice. I don't know whether that's good or bad. Last time I spoke to you, I was here as one of the authors of the bill. Today I'd like to speak to you with what I consider my real hat, and that is as a telehealth service provider. A lot of times I get called in to make the case, the human services case, the case that tugs at your heartstrings about, you know, saving people's lives and that sort of thing. And I don't think I need to make that case to you. I think I need to make a business case for health care in rural communities. And so that's what I would like to talk to you about today. We know that providing health care in rural areas is difficult at best. We find that in the frontier areas of rural Oregon, sometimes it's almost impossible, and sometimes there is no health care available except that provided by circuit providers who come around once a month or once every 2 weeks, and you have to have your appointment as it's scheduled and not when you really need health care. Otherwise, you get to drive to a metropolitan area if you want to
access health care in a timely fashion, or if you need subspecialty health care. Very often folks in rural areas have to drive to Portland. This means for people like Sherm a six-hour drive. Just one way, that means a loss of 2 days' work, sometimes three, depending on the health care that you want and the things that you have to have done. One of the disturbing things that came out of a study by the Association of Telemedicine Service Providers, which is based here in Portland, is that morbidity and mortality rates in rural areas of Oregon are significantly higher for some diseases, such as cardiac diseases and certain types of cancer, than they are in the urban areas. This correlates directly with the lack of subspecialty providers in those areas in rural Oregon. There are no cardiologists east of the Cascades. There are no oncologists east of the Cascades. So when we talk about people needing that type...
Excuse me, just one second. Sure. So over in Bend, in that area, there's no cardiologists and there's no oncologists.
And there's not any in
Pendleton. So the closest place to Eastern Oregon is going to be either Tri-Cities or Walla Walla or Boise.
Boise. That's correct. Chairman Crummell.
Thank you.
When people are faced with traveling long distances, many times they don't seek out the health care they need until the situation's become acute. At that point in time, insurance costs are going to be much higher to provide that acute care than it would be if we were dealing with the illness in its earlier phase. The other thing that we face with behavioral health is that we're faced with the higher incidences of suicide, and that was recently pointed out in Hardy County with the suicide of the three youth there. So we're talking about a much higher cost to insurance companies, to healthcare providers, and ultimately to the state of Oregon when these things go untreated. The advent of the second wave of telemedicine occurred in the early 90s, and when that happened, RodeoNet, which is a program that I manage in Eastern Oregon, was fortunate to be one of four operational telemedicine programs in the United States. And the Oregon Health Sciences University was way out on the front and leading edge of that. Oregon is no longer considered leading edge in telehealth services simply because we do not have the infrastructure to provide those services in our rural areas. The lack of infrastructure became one of the main issues in determining whether telehealth programs succeeded or failed. We could pay for the technology, the cost to come down. We could pay for the startup, the feds were willing to give us grants. But that ongoing $3,000 a month to pay for the line to one site often did a lot of rural telehealth providers in. And those programs did not succeed. And we still face that in Oregon, the lack of that broadband cost affordable infrastructure is simply not there. As it stands now, OHSU, which has some of the finest healthcare practitioners in the world, can provide better services to Japan and to Russia than they can to their constituents in rural Oregon. Recently, St. Charles Medical Center in Bend got a series of grants to provide telehealth services to people in rural, central, and southern Oregon. What occurred was that they could not get the infrastructure to provide those services. And in the areas where they could get the infrastructure, they ended up paying outrageous rates for those lines. They're currently paying $3,000 a month for a line to Lakeview. They do not know how much longer they can continue to do that and still stay operational.
Let me interrupt you for just a second. I apologize for interrupting you and kind of throwing you off. But what I'd like to do is try to bring you back sort of to, you know, specifically to the 142 issue and
yes.
how that's going
yes.
to, you know, what will 142 do for you in terms of...
If Representative Crummell, if that 142 will allow us as a state to build infrastructure where it's needed and we will not have to rely on the availability of grants, which are becoming much less available, to build that infrastructure as a singular community of interest. What we have, we pay for singly and on our own in many instances, which makes it very, very expensive. We've been told many times over that the Rural Health Care Corporation and the universal subsidy is brought about by the creation of that corporation will take care of rural health care infrastructure. To date, there's been no money paid for that, those subsidies. And people like the Siskiyou Health Center in Cave Junction are forking over $1,200 a month to pay for their T1 line to Grants Pass. If we had a backbone infrastructure, we would not be faced with having to pay those incredible rates, nor would we be faced with not being able to get lines to places where they're very much needed at all, places like Fossil, places like Christmas Valley, places like Heppner, places...
Let me interrupt you again.
I apologize. I just want to make sure that we don't give a false impression here in terms of the tariff rates or the tariff rate.
Right.
And Senate Bill 142 doesn't do anything about the tariff rate.
Exactly.
And so... so I guess in terms of the type of infrastructure you're talking about would may or may not be the type of infrastructure which is installed in terms of it's a frame switch and you're paying the backhaul circuit back to where the frame circuit is in terms of that's where you're getting some additional cost. So this may or may not. I don't want to get the...
No, my point...
Somebody's probably sitting here going, like, I don't know what you're talking about. But I just, my brief understanding, so that you understand in terms of the a user pays for a circuit from where the central office is to there to the end point.
Right.
And it's based upon different factors in terms of the distance is the big factor.
And the outages.
We're talking about other district services. and so in 142 may or may not affect that issue in terms of that it doesn't do anything to affect the rate that people are going to pay.
Right. Exactly.
Members, be clear of that.
What it does eliminate, though, is having to pay that tariff rate and then having to bear the full bore of the line for health care or for a school or whatever. That's a double whammy for and a situation that most health care corporations cannot pay for. What healthcare providers value most are not often the big central hub and spoke systems, but the community-to-community connections that allow them to keep their healthcare centers viable. For example, being able to connect to St. Charles helps keep Lakeview Hospital viable financially and also allows them access to the specialty care that's there. It allows them to keep patients in Lakeview, for example. Once a patient leaves a rural community to go to a secondary or tertiary care center, all the income that would come from providing that care goes out of the community. It does not stay there. And very often the patient does not come back for that type of care in the community. He continues to go to the secondary or tertiary care center. That provides an economic loss to not only the hospital, but to the community. But being able to do the follow-up care in the small rural clinic or the small rural hospital allows for the income to remain in the community. Many, many rural hospitals and clinics throughout the United States are closing, and we see telehealth as one of the opportunities for them to become more viable and to remain open. 142 would provide the infrastructure that would allow us to do that. Closing a rural hospital not only has a huge impact on healthcare for the community, but on the economics of the community. Many times those healthcare centers are one of the big economic employers. Once they close, that job loss is gone, that income loss is gone. If they are wanting to attract new families and new businesses, communities without healthcare are not attractive and are not considered places that people want to live. Healthcare lags behind in telecommunications use in general, but rural healthcare lags behind in light years behind. And if we are going to be able to provide care under the managed care system that we are creating, rural providers are not going to be able to keep up. Rural providers are not going to be able to provide the computerized billing, the patient record transfers, and the things that are needed to keep them up and going and viable members of the community. And so we really need that infrastructure in order to make them economically independent, economically healthy, and to be able to sustain health care in rural areas. And with that, I will quit and answer questions, any more questions that you might have, and urge you to consider 142 as one of those solutions.
Representative Hill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Did any of your group consortium, did you apply for federal E-rate dollars? No health care received any,
mm-hmm.
but in terms of did you, as a rule, encourage everyone to apply in case they do actually make the...
We encourage people that qualify to apply. RodeoNet did not apply because we are using the state of Oregon's EdNet system right now, and as the rules are written, those shared networks are not eligible for subsidy, particularly if private business or other than the specified organizations are allowed to buy off of that network. We felt that the collaboration that we had going with Oregon EdNet was more valuable and more cost-effective than applying for the rural healthcare funds. There have been 13 applications from Oregon by healthcare providers for that subsidy. I'm not sure how many of them have been accepted at this point. We're supposed to know if those funds are going to be released first round in May.
Any other questions? I do have one question with regards to the health care. You mentioned opening up, you mentioned that, for example, in east of the Cascades, there's no cardiology or oncology specialties. If Lakeview, for example, is linked to St. Charles in Bend, what do they do for oncology and cardiology type of advice, or are they also linked with OHSU in Portland?
At the point that type of subspecialty care is needed, then yes, they have to link with the tertiary care center. So it's kind of a compounded situation. The potential for having infrastructure that would allow Ben to link to other small rural communities might make it attractive enough for an oncologist or cardiologist or someone of the subspecialty area to come into Bend to set up practice. If he could be assured that he had a certain number of clients, regardless of whether he saw them face-to-face or he saw them using the technology, it might make that business lucrative. Then if you follow that a little further, maybe the morbidity and the mortality rates would fall with the availability of that subspecialty service.
And as another point, when you were talking about some of the infrastructure available and being able for doctors, clinics, and hospitals and that sort of thing, being able to link in, and you talked a little bit about records transfers and that sort of thing. I know one of the things that we've talked about in my office is having the providers carrying a laptop and actually keeping patient charts on the laptop, and then it would be downloaded to our main system within the building. So do you see some of the smaller docs going to that same type of a system so that they can cut their overhead expense as far as personnel is concerned? And then will that become a medium for then transferring records so that records are just picked out electronically and then transferred electronically as opposed to sending packets of stuff?
I think that the day and age of electronic records is here, and it's happening very quickly. I think that rural docs, particularly equipped with that type of technology, will be able to, first of all, transmit the needed information to their referring centers much more quickly. They'll be able to transmit it much more accurately. They'll also be able to receive it back in the same manner. I think that for purposes of billing and participating in managed care organizations, whether we like it or not, that's going to be a necessity.
Okay. Thank you. Did go ahead. Staff will get those for you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm Sean Radke, Economic Development Director for beautiful Lake County. And it was alluded to earlier, it was a beautiful drive up this morning, even though it took about six and a half hours. For those of you that know the area, Summer Lake was full of water about this time of year, and it's a very nice drive. I want to thank you for the opportunity for me to speak on behalf in support of Senate Bill 142. As I speak to you this afternoon, I'd like to like for you to imagine living in a small rural community in eastern Oregon and being told by a large telephone provider that in the 21st century you'll be lucky to still have dial tone for your telephone service. I was frankly quite alarmed to hear this when a member of the Oregon Telecommunications and Forum Council visited Lakeview and made this comment. And while the reasons for it were explained, it still is an alarming note. This statement was made in August of last year, 1998. These comments seem in direct conflict with the governor's commitment to improving telecommunications in eastern Oregon. Senator Wyden is on record as trying to improve telecommunications in eastern Oregon. Telecommunications technology allows for the creation of jobs anywhere and provides opportunities for towns and small cities in rural Oregon to compete. And the gist of my comments this afternoon are to show the link between telecommunications, the power of telecommunications, and the ability of small communities to compete for jobs. Before we get into some of the specifics of why such a statement was made, I would like to set the stage, if you're not familiar. Lake County in the past has been historically linked with timber and agriculture, as do many communities and counties in eastern Oregon. 78% of the land in Lake County is owned by the federal government. Because of this, many of the population in Lakeview are federal employees. The headquarters of the Fremont National Forest is in Lakeview. The district office of the Bureau of Land Management is in Lakeview. Fish and Wildlife Service has an office in Lakeview. Because of the challenges to the management of these federal lands, the timber supply has been drastically reduced and grazing opportunities have likewise been impacted. Consequently, Lake County has lost over 300 jobs in the last several years. These are in addition to the jobs being lost as the federal government downsizes because of the declining timber program, etc. This has a direct effect on the people of Lakeview, as many feel the community is beginning to stagnate. Where once smiles existed, we now have frowns. These people feel they want to stay there, but are losing the ability to retain the jobs and therefore are leaving. Recently, a local radio station did
In your discussions in terms of telecommunications,
right.
In terms of what type of reaction have you gotten from the local telephone? It's CenturyTel.
CenturyTel, right.
The local provider there.
Right.
In terms of have they, how do they answer the question? You say we want, some defined level of service. How do we get better access to the rest of the world? What is their answer in terms of is it capital? Is it return on investment? What is the rationale which either prevents or encourages them to meet these expectations that you need?
CenturyTel has told us that we have digital capability in Lakeview right now, which will basically do what a lot of these data processing companies demand. Unfortunately, convincing these data companies to look at a community like Lakeview without having fiber optics, for instance, they won't give us a first look. So it's kind of a paradox. We're not suggesting, for instance, that we do not have some capability. What we are afraid of, frankly, is we'll lose that capability if we don't have some stability in the industry.
Lakeview, is it served by digital radio? Is that how it's served?
Digital microwave, I believe. I continue. The street beat segment I was referring to by a local radio station, the question was asked, what do we need to do to improve economic conditions in Lakeview? And while there were many different answers, the overwhelming response is we need jobs. Job creations can happen in several ways, as you're all aware. recruitment and retention are the biggies. What is not mentioned is the power of telecommunications and the ability to overcome some of the obstacles to recruitment. I'd like to discuss some of these opportunities briefly and share with you some of the difficulties small and rural and remote communities such as Lakeview have in claiming success in recruitment.
Mr. Redke?
Yes.
Before you go into that discussion, I need to recess the committee for a few minutes so we can run down, check in, make sure that there's a quorum, and as soon as we know that, we will come back. And committee, I would ask you to please go down, check in, and as soon as they've got a quorum, please come right back. Let's not waste any time so that we can continue. Five minutes is what we're going to shoot.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I have a commitment in Portland. I'm going to be leaving at 5:30.
Okay. So we're in recess. So.